right? So in other words, the papers, i.e. the genetics that you're paying for when you pay for a, you know, a breeding of a nice stallion, you get a crisp, clean AQHA registration document, right? And then you fold it up, put it in your genes, and it goes through the washing machine and then the dryer, and that's the surrogate. And sometimes when it comes out of the dryer or the surrogate, it's perfectly legible. And then other times it's a complete disaster and you have to use scotch tape to put it back together. So that's my surrogate analogy, is because surrogates, even though they don't provide athletics or genetics or ability or try or heart or anything else to that foal, they for 7 months are the only input to that foal's behavior.
You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to The Ride, a podcast brought to you by Horse and Rider Magazine, hosted by Nicole Cherico and Emily Carey. This episode of The Ride is brought to you by Tribute Equine Nutrition. Let's be honest, no two horses are the same, so it should be no surprise their nutrition needs are different. Tribute Equine Nutrition Specialists help you create personalized feeding plans based on your horse and how you ride, whether that's long miles on the trail, a full day of work, or weekends spent doing what you love. Their feeds are backed by a 100% money-back guarantee made in their own Iona4-free facilities and are fixed formulas you can trust. So your horse gets consistent nutrition you can rely on, mile after mile, ride after ride. And if you're new to Tribute, your first bag is free, so you can try it with confidence. Take the stress out of feeding your horse and focus on what really matters, the ride. Visit TributeEquineNutrition.com to get started and let them know that Horse and Rider sent you.
Welcome back to The Ride. I'm your host, Emily Carey. By the time this episode of The Ride airs, we'll be in the middle of breeding season, so I thought it was a fitting time to have our next guest on. I'm so excited to be joined today by nationally respected expert in equine reproductive, infertility, and neonatal care, Dr. Ben Espy. Dr. Espy earned his veterinary degree from Texas A&M after studying biology at Duke University and trained under world-renowned equine reproduction specialists, an experience that shaped his approach to breeding horses. He's board certified in equine reproduction, licensed to practice acupuncture, and has served in leadership roles with the American Association of Equine Practitioners, the Texas Veterinary Medical Association, and others. Beyond the clinic, Dr. Espy has spent decades supporting horse welfare at the highest levels. He's a longtime veterinarian and consultant for the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association, has overseen vet practices for the San Antonio Stock Show and Rodeo for more than 20 years, and was a finalist for PRCA Veterinarian of the Year. He also serves on ethics and education committees that help guide the future of equine veterinary medicine. Simply put, when it comes to breeding, foaling, and giving mares and foals the best possible start, Dr. Espy brings an unmatched level of experience, and today we're so excited to tap into that knowledge. Dr. Espy, thank you so much for hopping on. I'm so glad to have you here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
So to get us started, can you tell us a little bit about why you decided to go into veterinary medicine and why you're focused on horses?
I'm a big believer in horse behavior. And when I was probably in junior high, I spent the summers mucking stalls at a large breeding facility at King Ranch. And I just felt very at home in the stall, and just kind of enjoyed being around horses and their energy, and went to, you know, time went on and started working in vet clinics when I was in high school, small animal clinics primarily. And I really never got that same feeling at the small animal clinic as I did when I was cleaning stalls. And so then when I went to vet school, I just horse medicine and horse surgery was easy for me. And so that's kind of the path that I went down. When I went to A&M, we had you could track small animal, large animal, or mixed. And I was the last year that you tracked large animal. And now you can even track even more specialized. You can track equine. And then so I tracked large animal, primarily equine. And then when I got out of school, I went to Lexington, Kentucky. And the interesting thing about veterinary medicine compared to human medicine is that straight out of graduate school, you can take a few years. So I practiced in private practice for 4 years after vet school, and then decided to go to Lexington and do a residency. And so I was there for 8 years. I worked at Haggard's and Rudenrodel both.
So I bet that was quite a jump going from quarter horses to thoroughbreds and all those things up there.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I went from a country vet practice, you know, where we were doing sheep and goats and cattle and doing C-sections on cows in the field and all that kind of stuff. Actually, some of your listeners may know of Bluebell ice cream. Well, at the time, Bluebell, they buy their milk now, but Bluebell's a very famous ice cream brand, at least in our region. And when I was in Brenham in the late 90s, Bluebell actually had their own dairy. And so they were our biggest client and had a number of dairy cows. And so that was one of my first accounts, actually, was going to the dairy and doing C-sections and displaced abomasums and all that stuff that people deal with in cattle medicine. So I had a little taste of that. That wasn't really for me. And I kind of always, you know, gravitated back towards the horses. And and Lexington was a obvious choice because Haggard's, for instance, has at the time I worked there in the early 2000s, we had 60 veterinarians, and about 15 or 18 of them were board certified specialists. So it was a great opportunity to kind of see what that was like. And then I'm from San Antonio, so I came back, and my dream was to do reproduction in San Antonio, and the working in a clinic didn't really pan out. I couldn't really find a place that I was comfortable. And so I started working out of my truck. And so that's kind of how I got involved with pro rodeo and ambulatory stuff. And now it's pretty crazy. I mean, I fly to a lot of clients and do reproduction work out of a suitcase. And it's really, really interesting and fulfilling because it's super challenging logistically, which is exciting for me. You know, getting mares to cycle in a different state and then flying up there to ultrasound them and things like that. So that's something I really enjoy.
So you must be on the road all the time, especially now this time of year.
Yeah, I drive about, my CPA just did my taxes for last year, and I drove 64,000 miles, I usually spend about 3 days a week in another state about every, I'd say once a month. So I make a work trip, maybe like a 3 day work trip once a month, to various clients in other states. And then I drive about 60,000 miles a year, in Texas.
That's insane. That's incredible.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. Funny side story. I actually have, I practice out of a suburban now, but I have 3 Ford excursions, and one has 650,000 miles. One has 450 and then one has 250. So I literally have driven over 1 million miles in a Ford excursion. I told when I went to go buy my Chevrolet Suburban, I told them I wanted a free one, and they were like, well, you should ask Ford because we're not going to give you a free Suburban.
You should, like, sponsor me, please.
Yeah, totally.
That's
anyway, yeah, no, I have a lot of I spend more time driving than looking at horses. So
I'm sure you see some really cool things on the side of the road.
Oh yeah, no, totally. Yeah, that's why I do it, you know, because it's just fascinating to me, and I've really enjoyed working for people outside of Texas. I mean, my Utah clients are different than my Colorado clients, and versus my Montana clients. I've got some draft horses in Indiana, so it's just been really, really awesome. I mean, it's just different people, different breeds of horses, different jobs that the horses have. It's just been, I mean, I would do it all over again. I'm a big proponent. Pro Rodeo's got an initiative now to where we're trying to recruit young veterinarians. And I hear a lot of horse vets that are very burned out. There's a high rate of suicide. It's kind of a national problem with equine veterinarians. And I'm one of those, one of the people on the other end of the spectrum. I would do it 1,000 times over.
Oh, that's incredible to hear. And obviously you've seen so much, you know, like you just mentioned, you've gone everywhere, seen everything, and you've seen a lot of the practices kind of change over the years. So when this episode airs, we'll be in the middle of breeding season. Can you tell us a little bit about how your industry has changed over the years, how getting mares pregnant has evolved?
Well, when I started cleaning stalls at King Ranch, I'm going to date myself, but ship semen was not an option. So the reason King Ranch got so famous was because we had some really good stallions there. We had 4 stallions. Most people know who they were. We had Mr. San Pepe, Little Pepe, and Dry Dock were the 3 most famous stallions. And so we had 600 King Ranch mares and 400 outside mares. So we had 1,000 mares at King Ranch. And the reason was we didn't have any ship semen. You couldn't ship semen and register with AQHA. So that's how King Ranch became so well known, is because if you wanted to breed to King Ranch bloodlines, you had to ship your mare to Kingsville, which is like in the at the bottom of the earth. So, between high school and when I went to vet school is when AQHA allowed you to register ship semen. And of course now, embryo transfer is common. And I would even say in the last 5 years, even ICSI is common. So we're taking a singular sperm cell, cutting off the tail and mechanically inserting it into a harvested egg. And that is truly commonplace. I never thought I'd say that, but, we're taking one oocyte from a mare and we're taking one singular sperm from a stallion, and we're getting very, very repeatable success with that procedure. And I would imagine that the large majority of people that are listening to this podcast have either done ICSI themselves or at least heard of it. It's just a very rapidly evolving technology. And it's opened up a lot of the industry because now people have surrogates, and there are veterinarians that only do embryos. There are veterinarians that only do ICSI. There are veterinarians that only do stallions. So there are a lot of little niche options in my industry. I don't look at any stallions at all. I only do mares and I only do ambulatory services. So I don't have a hospital where I don't have a herd of surrogates or anything like that. I basically get asked to go around either by airplane or car, and evaluate mares and their suitability for breeding. And then I do, one of the things that I feel very comfortable with is synchronizing mares. So I will synchronize, I work on a lot of bucking horse, mares. And, so I feel very comfortable, synchronizing bucking horses and then flying up there on a certain day to ultrasound them and breed them and then fly home. That's the kind of cool stuff that I get to do.
That's awesome. I was able to see it happen once and it like blew my mind. I'm from the Northeast and it's
really
a completely different world when you get out into the Texas side of breeding and, you know, all the different options and how that works.
It's amazing too. And I mean, you know, going back to the whole rodeo world, if you think about, if the listeners are familiar with the NFR and pro rodeo and, you know, kind of the rodeo circuit, like it's actually kind of timely too for me because, you know, we're in the middle of Fort Worth rodeo right now, and we just had Denver, and then we have San Antonio next week, and then Houston's after that. So we have kind of the rodeo, we call it the Texas swing, is coming through here, and, it's pretty unbelievable when you look at the contestants, because pretty much everybody who's highly ranked in that sport is in Texas or west of Texas. So there's a very, it's a very interesting dynamic. Like when I was in Lexington, you know, my whole world was fixated on thoroughbreds. And then you forget there's a completely other community out there that's in the western part of the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely. It is, you know, nationwide, wherever you go, everyone does a different practice. It's completely different. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Can you walk us through a little bit about, you know, on the back end of some of those procedures and the processes that you do that a lot of us don't get to see in the front? How does that all work? Like what goes into sinking mares and you know, flushing and all those things?
Well, people like me, I've just seen so many mares, and it's not really an educational advantage, meaning that like I was very fortunate to go to a good college at Duke, and went to a fantastic vet school at A&M, and then went to a, you know, a really famous clinic in Lexington. So I definitely have had my exposure to really good medicine. But I think a lot of it comes from scanning mares, meaning that all of the decisions I make are not textbook based, meaning that all of my decisions daily are from horse numbers. Like, for instance, when you're in Lexington, a typical ambulatory practitioner in Lexington is going to scan 50 to 70 mares a day. So if you think about that, you know, so I'm doing 70 mares a day, 7 days a week for 6 months. So I don't know what the numbers are. I mean, we could actually figure that out, but that's, so 70 mares a day times 7 days a week. So that's 490 mares a week times 24 weeks. So every breeding season, a veterinarian is going to scan 11,000 mares. So I was there for 8 years. So just in Lexington, Kentucky, I scanned 88,000 times. So then when you get to Texas, the breeding is not as aggressive as the thoroughbred world, but in your memory bank or experience bank, I came to Texas 20 years ago, and I mean, I'm from San Antonio, but I moved back 20 years ago. So I arrived in Texas having ultrasounded 88,000 mares. So, that's the first thing people need to understand is yes, you can buy an ultrasound. You can learn an ultrasound. You can go to a 4-day seminar and learn how to ultrasound, that kind of thing, but nothing replaces the 88,000 mares that you have watched ovulate, go into heat and ovulate. And so that's kind of why people hire me, because the way I look at ovaries, the way I look at a uterus, a common thing that veterinarians forget to do or get busy and omit is looking at the cervix. So on many of the mares that I examine, I actually stick a sterile speculum in their vulva and look visually at the cervix. So those are all things that that I do to make a thorough exam. And then, of course, all of the, so preparation, knowing how to manipulate the hormones, knowing what time mares are going to be receptive to the certain hormones is super important. And just logistically with my practice, when I'm driving everywhere, like I can't drive from San Antonio to Houston, which is 200 miles, and go back. Like I have to make a really solid decision on that trip about what hormones the mare needs or how she's going to progress in her cycle, because I can't go back every day like you do in a situation with your local veterinarian where they might come out on Monday and then come back on Tuesday and then maybe they come back on Thursday. Like I've got pretty much, you know, 2 or 3 exams during my cycle to where I can make good decisions. And so it's really enhanced my skill but just from logistics, because I just can't physically get to every mare every day. So that's kind of a backstory on that. And then the other thing is the breeds of horses, like working on, like I work on Percherons and I work on bucking horses, and the doses are different. The ovulation speed is different. That kind of thing. And that's, so all the stuff that I do is really interesting, but it's not anything like these reproduction centers that have herds of surrogates. And those guys are highly, highly skilled, in harvesting oocytes, and doing ICSI and doing embryo transfers. Like, just for example, like I know how to do an embryo transfer, but just for example, at any well-respected embryo transfer facility, they will do more in 1 week than I have done in my entire year, entire life. Sorry. So that's something to remember. And again, it's experience, because it has nothing to do with your intelligence, schooling, anything. So that's kind of what I would emphasize to people, is that when you're hiring somebody or a so-called expert, a lot of the expert, like I would say one of my closest friends and one of the best embryo technicians that I know is not even a veterinarian. But he's done tens of thousands of embryos. And so that's a little nuance about veterinary medicine that's very interesting, is because there are people that do ICSI and there are people that do embryo transfers, and they're not even veterinarians, and they're highly, highly skilled at the procedure.
I still can't get over the 88,000. That's
the numbers. Isn't that nuts? I mean,
they are, yeah. And thinking about how many have been since, yeah.
Yeah. And that's kind of my point, is that it's just, you can't wrap your head around it, you know, because that's 10,000 a year. And I've been practicing, you know, 30 years. I mean, I got out in 96. So this is my 30th year. So, you know, I scan less mares now because, of course, I have to drive further, living in Texas. But, you know, if you stay in Lexington, Kentucky, it's very believable that you, in your career, you'll scan 500,000 mares. And I think those numbers are very, and it's not a bragging thing. I'm not saying me personally, I'm saying just vets in general. Like, you just don't even appreciate when a veterinarian, or when a client or one of your listeners has a veterinarian, I just don't think that skill or that experience is given adequate notice, because it's like when you hire someone and they've literally scanned 200,000 mares, you can't replicate that. It's just a lot of hours and a lot of heartache. And it's a physical toll on your body. I mean, I have many, many friends that have had to quit from shoulder issues and neck issues and things like that. You know, any sort of repetitive motion like that is very, very difficult. And so that's another kind of interesting thing about my world, is it's physical. It's, you know, it's funny. I joke with my farrier friends, you know, it's not as bad as being a farrier, but it's close.
You took the words right out of my mouth. I was just going to comment, like, you know, you really can't replicate experience. And, you know, you see that many mares, you know a lot more than anyone else, really.
Yeah. They're great textbooks and stuff that you can learn about the science of it. But, you know, there's never been a mare that's read a textbook, right? So you can read about mare cycling, but, you know, any veterinarian, not just me, but any veterinarian exceeds textbook level knowledge probably 5 to 8 years into practice.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously there's the part of it that I want to talk about that happens before you get your hands on the mare. Before, you know, the decisions that an owner has to make to choose, oh, I'm going to breed this mare to this stallion. From a vet's perspective, what are some things that mare owners should be thinking about when they're trying to decide, you know, to go forward with breeding, to do that? Like, how important is a mare's history when making those decisions?
Well, one of the questions that you sent me before this podcast was similar to, or brought up some stuff in my head. And, you know, as I mentioned a little while ago, you know, I work on a lot of bucking horses at a high level. And a close friend and mentor of mine is a guy named Greg Venneklausen, and Greg knows more. Greg's a veterinarian in Canyon, Texas, and he knows more about blood, about bucking horse bloodstock than anybody in the world, truly. He can recite by memory most of the famous bloodlines in the pro rodeo bucking horse world. And he and I together work on some of the better bucking horses in the world. And we believe that bucking is genetic. That skill is genetic. You can see it in every discipline, whether it's thoroughbred racing or jumping or cutting horses or calf roping horses, whatever. So that's the first thing we understand is athletic talent is genetic. And it's the same way with people. You know, when you have an Olympic athlete who marries a, you know, college Division I football player, they're going to have typically athletic children. There are hundreds of stories of siblings that play in the NFL. You know, like two brothers playing in the NFL, two brothers playing in the NBA. So we know that athletic performance is genetic. I think one of the things that we're getting into big difficulty now is that with all these assisted reproduction, embryo transfer, ICSI stuff, people forget there's a surrogate involved. So you take a genetically superior female harvester eggs. You take a genetically superior stallion and stick his sperm into that egg, and then you create an embryo. Well, that embryo goes into a surrogate mare, just as it would in a person. And that surrogate mare, what people forget is, even though that surrogate provides no genetic material to that embryo, they're basically an incubator. That foal, the resulting foal, is going to live with that surrogate for 4 to 7 months, depending on when you wean. So even though that foal has the genetic input of two great athletes, they are being taught how to be a horse by the surrogate. So the reason a lot of horses are surrogates is because they're very, very difficult. They're difficult to handle. They're unmanageable. They are failed athletes. They are basically discarded horses that we use as incubators. So that's something that people forget. People will put a really, really nice embryo in a surrogate that you can't even touch. And then when the foal comes out, that mare, the surrogate mare, teaches her foal how to be fearful of people. And so that's something that's very interesting. So we have these incredibly valuable foals that are coming out of surrogates that are behaviorally subpar. And so that's something that the industry is having to deal with now, I believe, is, you know, we have to almost retrain these babies to maximize their potential, because the surrogate mare has, she's done a fantastic job for us, meaning incubating and raising the baby. But at the same time, the reason she's a surrogate is she's probably frequently hard to handle. And so, you know, you have a really expensive foal that's been taught to, you know, be difficult to manage.
Yeah, I think that's like, there's always arguments online of people saying, oh, you can't ride papers. But I think you just hit that kind of spot on, like, genetics are so important. But then there is that other factor of, can you handle the horse? Like, and I think you really just kind of summed up a lot of those arguments with, you know, both sides. And yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that I would say that the whole comment about you can't ride papers, here's my theory on that. Yes, I disagree. You can ride papers. But the caveat is You can ride papers, but you have to remember that those papers get crumpled up and they get stuck in your pocket and go through the washing machine and then the dryer. And then you realize that the papers are in the dryer and you pull them out. And that's the horse that you've created, right? So in other words, the papers, i.e. the genetics that you're paying for when you pay for a, you know, a breeding of a nice stallion, you get a crisp, clean AQHA registration document, right? And then you fold it up, put it in your jeans, and it goes through the washing machine and then the dryer, and that's the surrogate. And sometimes when it comes out of the dryer or the surrogate, it's perfectly legible. And then other times it's a complete disaster and you have to use scotch tape to put it back together. So that's my surrogate analogy, is because surrogates, even though they don't provide athletics or genetics or ability or try or heart or anything else to that foal, they for 7 months are the only input to that foal's behavior.
I think that's the best analogy I've heard in a very long time.
Well, I've got a lot of analogies.
So we bred a mare. What kind of veterinary care should be standard throughout a pregnancy after the breeding's done?
Well, I keep using the bucking horse analogy. I mean, obviously, Western performance horses are kind of my primary focus. But when I practice on Western performance horses, I always use the feral horse as a good sounding board when deciding whether to prolong life, whether to treat a horse a certain way, whether to, you know, ethical decisions is what I'm saying. And so I believe that a feral horse is a very good way to pump the brakes and reassess what you're doing as an owner, meaning that is this what the horse wants? You have to be respectful as a veterinarian to know what the horse wants, what is best for the horse. I have no commitment to the owner. I never took any oath to take care of any owner, right? My only concern and priority is to take care of the animal. And so along those same lines, I let mares gestate the best I can. The veterinary AEP recommendations I follow, meaning that we vaccinate them for herpes virus abortion 5, 7, and 9 months of gestation. And then we vaccinate them 4 to 6 weeks before their due date with the core vaccines that are recommended by AEP. And we deworm them at that time because they transmit ascarids in the milk. And those are, you know, the primary parasites that newborn foals get from suckling. And another thing to go to my hands-off approach is as a boarded repro person, I can tell you that the recommendation from all the experts is to keep a pregnant mare at the same feed level as you would a non-pregnant mare. So I feed all of my pregnant mares the same amount as geldings. And then in the last trimester of gestation is when they start creating milk. And that's when we increase their feed by 25 to 30%. So that's the primary thing I see people do, is they get a mare pregnant and then the gestation's 11 months. And so, you know, 30 days after they've been diagnosed pregnant, they start pouring the feed to them and then the mares get obese and then they have difficulty in raising the foal and actually having the foal. So I'm a big believer. I when I get asked to speak at conventions and things, I always use the analogy of, and most women will agree, most human women, as they'll say, I always make the reference to having a baby is an athletic event. And everybody who's had a child will agree with that. And if you think about it, so I like to keep my broodmares athletically fit. And that includes exercising. It includes competing on them. It includes feeding them the same as when they weren't pregnant. I routinely advise my clients to exercise and compete and keep using the mares until they're, 6 to 7 months pregnant. And then we kind of shut them down and then let them be a mom. And then that's when we increase their feed.
I'm so glad you said that, because I think that's such an important thing that a lot of people don't understand, is that like they are still, athletes. And I think that food part was very interesting to learn. We haven't bred a mare since I was a child. So I'm learning a lot here today too, which is awesome. I think that's really, really cool to know. We've talked about the breeding and all that a lot. Now, when we talk about foaling out, and I think that was a really good leadway into that, obviously we all hope for a successful foaling, for, dam and foal to come out of it healthy, no issues, with as little, intervention as possible. But we've also all heard about the horror stories about, the awful losses that, what are some of the most common foaling complications that you see that are preventable?
Well, I think the number one thing that I get asked about is, where are you going to be when this mare foals? And I say, not available. And I'm kind of being smart-ass about it, but I'm also being very honest about it. And that's why people, I probably irritate a lot of people, and I also have a very loyal following for being honest, because the normal foaling process takes about 15 to 20 minutes. And there's no way, even if the mare lives in your backyard, that you are going to be able to watch a mare and catch the 15 minutes that she foals. People have cameras, people do a good job with night watchmen. It is possible to find a mare foaling, but in general, for a normal person, a famous story was when I lived in Lexington, I lived on a broodmare farm with 340 mares, and people are like, oh my gosh, you probably had all this experience with foaling. And every night I lived probably 100 yards from the foaling, from the mare barn. And they had a full-time night watchman literally walk the halls all night, 12 hours, walk the halls up and down, up and down, up and down. Every time a mare would foal, he would run to my house where I lived with my wife. And I would put on my overalls, just, underwear and overalls, and slide on my muck boots and run to the foaling, to the mare barn. And in the 8 years I was there, I would see maybe 5 foals born per year out of 340. And the reason is because when mares decide to foal, it's a very explosive and violent event. And when you have a mare, you can assist a mare who is if she's not successful in the 20-minute time period, you can help a mare. But you really, once you figure out she's in trouble, you're in dire straits. And you pretty much have about, after that 20-minute time period goes by, that's normal, and you figure out she's in trouble, you probably have another 15 minutes to get the foal out before, he succumbs to, oxygen deprivation and all that stuff. So you can imagine when all this stuff is happening at lightning speed, calling a veterinarian and expecting a veterinarian to come out there and rescue the day is not realistic. It's not logistically possible. And most of the assistance that veterinarians give horses are pulling dead foals. Foals that get stuck, malposition foals, things like that. So that's the main thing to take home, is that people that foal mares need to get very experienced with that process. And if they are not, if they are sending their mares to a foaling facility, one of my pet peeves is the misleading of people, or maybe it's misunderstanding of people. When you take your mare to a vet clinic, and they keep the mare at the vet clinic for foaling observation, unless there's a human standing there in the hallway, you cannot assist her. Meaning that if you're looking at a video camera, you have to virtually be living at the clinic to assist a mare that has difficulty during foaling. So that's the main thing. So if you're okay with that, that's fine. And I'm okay with that. Honestly, I prefer to have mares foal on their own with no assistance. So in Kentucky, the mares obviously are too valuable. Weatherford, Stephenville, Texas, you know, the mares are too valuable. We can't afford to leave them to their own devices. But pretty much in 99% of horses in the world, a 15-minute foaling is common. Then about an hour, you know, horses, as we all know, their main source of defense is escaping a predator. So within about an hour of foaling, the foal should be standing and nursing, or at least standing. About 2 hours of age, the foal should be nursing. And then at 3 hours of age, the mare should have already expelled her placenta. And in the wild, that's when the herd leaves. So if you have a herd of 300 feral horses in Wyoming, they may stop and allow a mare to foal. But after about 3 or 4 hours, that herd moves on. And that mare has an option of staying with her friends. And sometimes she does, and sometimes the foal gets left. But it's a very interesting species because a mare goes from pregnant to having a baby on the ground, a nursing baby on the ground, and a herd that keeps moving through the mountains in 3 hours. And so I think that's kind of the analogy that's best for people to understand is, you know, having a straw-filled mahogany stall in Lexington, Kentucky, where I was very fortunate to have practiced, is not realistic or real life for millions of horses around the world. And so I think as long as you understand the normal process, I think it's you get less anxiety because there are foals that die and you can't help them. There are mares that get in trouble, and it's not a reason to be upset at your veterinarian because it's physically impossible for them to get to your aid fast enough. So that's just part of the brutal reality of the way God set it up. They're fascinating creatures, and they're very solitary in their efforts, meaning that they don't want help. It's very rare that humans can help them. And if you have to help them, you have a big wreck on your hands. So those are all really, really cool things about a horse.
Yeah, I think you just hit so much information. We've talked about so much during the last, 40 minutes. And I'm really grateful for you to coming on and sharing that information with us. I think a lot of our listeners are really going to appreciate this episode and learn a lot. I know I've learned a lot while we've been chatting. So I guess to kind of wrap us up, Dr. Atisby, if you could share one piece of advice for mare owners, as they look to breed or getting into breeding, what advice would you give them?
I think it's a cost, honestly. It's really crazy. My practice is so crazy. I'm so blessed and fortunate. I think a lot of it, I've had really good experience So, I mean, I think that I can provide good care for horses. But I think a lot of the industry helps us as veterinarians, because people have to, they're almost forced to provide good care for these horses, because it's very common, even at the high school rodeo level, for me to work on horses that are $100,000, $200,000. I mean, not all the time, but I mean, I would say probably like maybe 3 weeks ago, I guess, like right after Christmas, I did a pre-purchase exam on a $220,000 high school rodeo horse. And, you know, it's just mind-blowing money. So the amount of money that's available, or that's out there for these parents and these kids and for just owners in general, it's just, I mean, it's very common to have a gelding that works in a feedlot cost 40 grand. And that's just, we've never seen those prices before ever. So I think that as far as breeding goes, I love it, obviously. Hopefully you can tell from my responses, I love it. But at the same time, I also talk a lot of people out of breeding, which is kind of funny. Because if you think about the cost of the ICSI, the cost of the semen, the cost of the surrogate, and people always like, they tell me, oh my gosh, I've got this fantastic mare and I want to breed her. It's like, okay, well, it's going to cost you $1,000 a year to feed the mare. It's costing you $1,000 to feed the surrogate per year. It's going to cost you, say, $3,000 to buy the semen. It's going to cost you $5,000 to do the ICSI and the, you know, transfers. It's going to cost you about $20,000 to $30,000 to train that foal. So from having a little twinkle in your eye to getting a usable athlete, assuming they're 4 or 5 years old, is going to cost you about $40,000. So I always tell people, and they're appreciative of this, if you are creating a foal that's worth $30,000 to $40,000, then 100% go for it. If you believe that you are creating a foal that's worth $30,000, then absolutely. If you have sentimental reasons to create a foal, then absolutely do it. But you can also buy very, very skilled and great horses for that kind of money. So that's my number one thing, as I tell clients, is just don't start the process until you know how deep you're going to get. Because it's not just real, I mean, it's real magical when everything comes together. But at the same time, I get very nervous when I have people that I think they get misled, honestly. I think they get misled and, you know, oh my gosh, my mare matches up perfect with the stallion. And then they don't think about the fact that they're not even going to be like the mares that I'm breeding right now this spring. They're not even going to be competing until 2030. So there's a lot of bills between now and then. And if you can rationalize that, then go for it. And if you have trepidation about that, then maybe you should hold off. And you know, just be more, I guess, cautious. You know. So anyway, it's pretty funny. I'm probably the only boarded OBGYN that tells you not to breed horses, but I do a lot.
But hey, you know, we need more of that honesty rather than just selling people to do things. So thank you so much for talking to us. Where can people find you? Do you have social media or website that people can learn more about your practice and about you?
Yeah, I have it's kind of funny. I've never had a business name. I don't know why. I've kind of toyed with it for a long time, and it's always just been Ben Espy, just like Bend Like in Benjamin, and then ESPY. I have a Facebook page. It's public. And I have lots of, my kid does high school rodeo. He's super, super good at bareback riding. I've got kids rodeo. I've got my own kids rodeo on there. I've got my son's graduation on there. I've got my daughter's, you know, living through the snowstorm in Boston on there. So if people are, I have got really cool vet stuff on there, but I also have a lot of family stuff on there because I think in my world, my wife's a veterinarian also. In my world, everything is one big jumble of fun. My kids all grew up in a car seat on horse calls. And so I've tried to honor them through the years, and kind of show them growing up and doing their deal. And they also have cool things on there about, veterinary tips and tricks and cool pictures and all that. So that's on Facebook. And then, I also have an Instagram page, and then that's just at BenSBDVM.
Awesome. Well, thank you. Thank you again. Thank you so much. Appreciate you taking the time to join us.
Once again, we'd like to thank Tribute Equine Nutrition for sponsoring this episode of The Ride. Thank you guys for tuning into The Ride podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and please be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow Horse and Rider Magazine on social media and find us at horseandrider.com to see all the cool things that we're up to. And if you have any comments or questions, please be sure to hit us up at horseandrider@equinenetwork.com. We want to hear from you guys. And if you like what you're listening to, please be sure to leave us a review on iTunes.